Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Greetings and salutations to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Judo Chop Suey Podcast, and I'm your host, Judo Dave Roman, coming back at you with another episode. I know it's been a while. I promised that I would try and get back to an every 2 week cycle, but you know what happened? I got sick in January. I got, now according to tests, I didn't have COVID and I didn't have the flu. But I tell you what, from December 31st all the way through about January 28th, I was sick for most of that time, with the exception of one weekend, and that happened to be the weekend that I drove down to Tampa to watch my Tampa Bay Buccaneers beat the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, unfortunately, they lost to the Rams, so they are not in the Super Bowl, which is going to be happening this coming up weekend on February 13th. I can't wait for that game. I'm rooting for the Bengals to win. But that being said, I'm not here to talk about football. I'm here to talk about judo. And I'm here specifically to talk about the Paris Grand Slam, which happened over the weekend of February 5th and 6th. And to help me break down the Paris Grand Slam, I have a special guest for you all. He's actually the second guest I ever had on this podcast nearly 5 years ago. And he's back. My guest to break down the Paris Grand Slam is Christian Castaneda. He is a resident of both Canada and the United States, but currently residing in Canada, in British Columbia, if I got that right. So ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Christian Castaneda. Welcome back. Christian, welcome back to the Judo Chop Suey Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's great to be back. Love judo, so I love to talk about judo, especially here.
Yeah, especially you. Now, you are my second guest the second guest ever on the Judo Chop Suey Podcast. The last time you were on was, now according to my notes, back around May of 2017. And for years I've been saying, I got to get you back on. We talked a little bit on Instagram via IM direct message, and I had to commit to it. I had to say, look, come on to the podcast, watch the Paris Grand Slam. We're going to talk about this. But before we get on to the Paris Grand Slam, tell me what's been going on with you over the past almost 5 years. The last time you were on, you were a NICU. I don't think you're a NICU anymore, right?
Yeah. So I tested for Shodan in December 2019, right before everything went down.
Yeah.
So I did the kata and got my belt and broke my hand. That was fun.
Did you really? During the kata?
No. It was the first class as a black belt. I broke my hand.
How'd you manage that?
I fractured a bone in my hand. It was a spazzy green belt. How we were doing Nawaza and just freak accident.
Oh,
felt a pop and yeah.
That's awful.
But it's healed now. a few years later, you know. Yeah. It was not that bad.
How long did it take you to recover? Just a few months? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was back. I practiced, I think, for 2 weeks. I got the clear to go back to practice 2 weeks right before lockdown.
Wow.
So how did that not fun.
How did you and your family manage during the pandemic? I mean, I know we're still under a pandemic still, but how did you and your family manage? You managed to stay healthy? You ever catch it?
No, I did. I caught what I assume is Omicron.
On
Christmas. Yeah. But you know, I got my vax and I was relatively mild for me.
Yeah.
So I'm happy. I didn't spread it to anyone I know.
Yeah. I was sick most of this past January. I mean, I got tested for the flu. I got tested for COVID. It both were negative. I don't know. I felt all right. I didn't go to practice for most of January, but I was definitely sick for most of the month. I'm fine now. It's part of the reason why I haven't had an episode release in a month. I had wanted to commit to doing, you know, every 2 weeks at least, but I got sick, and when I'm sick, I don't record because it just, my voice sounds wrong. And then I have to pause every 5 seconds to cough and stuff like that. It's just not good for me. So how have you managed to do any sort of training, any sort of skill upkeep during the pandemic at all? Now, I know you go back and forth between California and Canada. Where have you been mostly during the pandemic?
During the pandemic, mostly here in Canada.
Canada, Vancouver. Okay. Yeah. You're in Vancouver.
So,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I didn't go home for a year or year and a bit. So
Yeah.
But training, we came back in July of last year.
Okay.
So that was fun to do. And then I feel like we had some restrictions again when things got bad with the Omicron wave here in around Christmas time, but those have since eased with the cases gone down.
Yeah.
So we're back to practice. No problem.
Good. Now, when you talk about practice, are you doing strictly judo? Are you doing other things? Are you teaching now that you're a Shodan? Are you still a student doing other things like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or maybe Sambo, or I don't know, whatever the case may be. What have you been doing?
So I'd say it's mainly judo. Now I do have a class of my own. Teaching Sambo once a week.
Yeah. Cool. So cool.
I get to be the only instructor. I get to have my own curriculum because I helped out with beginners at the university club for judo, but it's nice to have my own gig.
Sure. Of course. Now, how did you get into Sambo?
I've had my original instructors here at the university for judo. One of them had been part of the Sambo club that was here in the 2000s and early and late 90s. And his instructor, Vadim, I've taken a class with before. He still lives here in the city. And over the years, I've met a lot of people from former Soviet Union or Eastern Bloc countries that have had Sambo experience. And I always ask them, show me something and then back home, there's been people I've known as well. Learned from Victor Koga is another name. Yeah.
Now, when you have learned Sambo, I know very little about Sambo. I've seen it. I've never had a formal lesson from any Sambist. When you teach Sambo, do you teach it with Russian names? Are the techniques in Russian? Or do you just use English terminology? Do you just refer to judo's terminology? How do you teach Sambo in that regard?
So I mostly teach beginners.
Okay.
But if I had, eventually I'll get them to use the judo names because I feel like if they want to continue to be good at Sambo, they should probably do judo. It's the closest that they can get.
So
I'm using English names so far just to get it in their head. But I'll transition to judo names as appropriate. I could use some of the Russian names, but they're not that specific. Like, what is it? A podvat. A podvat is not exactly like so detailed, like a harai versus an oguruma versus an osoto. A podvat is a podvat. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. That's really interesting. Now, how do you like training in, I believe the uniform is called a kurtka?
Yeah.
How do you like that compared to your standard judo gi?
I think it's just different. The belt placement, I think, is interesting. It doesn't sit so low on the hips. It's a little bit more in the middle. It's basically a gi, and
yeah,
the shorts are fine. The shoes I feel like are a bit slippy because it's not a soled shoe like you would have with the wrestling shoe.
It's you not. Actually, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like thought it was. It real. Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's like a suede sock almost, but a little bit more structured than say a suede sock. Yeah. So you can still pivot on the ball of your foot like you would for any turn throw.
Wow. So you don't have I had no idea.
You don't have to, you know, plant and turn like you would in a wrestling shoe because you can't pivot on the ball of your foot. You can still do that in a sambo shoe.
That's fast. All these years, I just assumed they were wearing wrestling shoes. I had no clue. Wow.
Yeah.
Learn something new every day. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. So now how about the last time I spoke with you, at least on air, you were going to, you were pursuing a college degree. Did you complete that? Where were you at in terms of your education?
Yeah. So I completed my bachelor's degree. I got a bachelor's in applied animal biology, and I.
Well, that's fantastic. Congratulations. Yeah, that's
thank
great.
You.
It was University of Vancouver?
University of British Columbia.
British Columbia. Okay. That's yeah. Right.
So I'm looking for a job at the moment, and doing, you know, life stuff. Like I've been struggling to import my vehicle, since I'm not a student anymore. It's time. And that's a big process. There's a lot of red tape with that. I didn't realize
to bring your vehicle from the United States to Canada. That's a problem.
Yeah. It's taken me like weeks to, I'm still not completely done with it. I need to get it insured and stuff. So, but
no,
yeah, not fun.
I can't remember. Do you have dual citizenship?
I do. Yeah,
you do. Okay.
I have three citizenships actually.
You do, yeah. Really? Mexico, is that right?
Mexico, yeah.
That's right. Because I know your last name is Latino, or at least it comes across that way to me. I'm Puerto Rican. I think you knew that though, so yeah. That's why I could pick up on that. So, are you fluent in Spanish?
I'm not fluent, but I'd say I speak broken Spanish. I've gotten better over the years.
I took
some courses in it. So
yeah, I'm the same way. I'll speak Spanish with my family. Because they tend to all have the same types of conversations when I see them. So I'm pretty comfortable with that. But, and, you know, if I was dropped off and, you know, in Mexico, I could get by for sure. But I don't feel comfortable. The problem is that I think in English when I speak Spanish, that's my biggest challenge. I'm not completely fluent. So, well, great catching up with you in regards to that. Now, I brought you on because we want to talk about the Paris Grand Slam, which is one of the biggest events on the International Judo Federation World Tour. Before we get into that, what I want to get your opinion on some of the rule changes heading into this Olympic cycle. What are your thoughts on really the changes as a whole?
I think the changes as a whole, they were for the better. You know, I think the backlash of banning a technique kind of took the news of these rule changes. But if you really look back at them with, say, fresh eyes now that the controversy of the reverse Senagi ban is kind of died down, I think you'll see that they're good changes, in my opinion.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. You know, one thing that I'm going to cover it now. One thing I didn't cover in my last episode, I completely blew over it, was the uniform changes. I don't know about mm-hmm. you. I thought the uniforms looked significantly larger. I didn't think a few centimeters here and there would be noticeable, but to me, the uniforms looked much larger. I don't know if you caught that, but,
Yeah. So I thought it was funny. A friend of mine pointed it out when I was watching the minus 60, Ryuju had an Adidas gi. And I think it's really funny to see, you know, the Japanese always wear, their, I don't know, their Kusakura mm-hmm. or their, what's the other one?
Mizuno.
The volleyball one. Mizuno. They always wear those geese, but to see them in an Adidas gi was was pretty funny. I think a lot of people's geese got called. So
yeah, I saw a lot of
IGF patches.
Exactly. I was going to say the same thing. I saw a lot of IGF patches. I know Amadine Bouchard of France openly complained on the IGF's Instagram page about the uniform changes. I thought it was really interesting to see some of the athletes not only complain about the uniform issue, but also follow up on her post. I saw Fabio Basile of Italy make mention of something as well under her comments. It seems like the athletes, some people are suggesting that this is just a money grab by the IJF to make more money in selling geese. I don't know if that's the case, but apparently getting the geese properly measured was a problem for a lot of the athletes.
One thing I noticed in the commentary booth, I think the Neil second is Sheldon. Sheldon mentioned in one of the Japanese, it was a Japan versus Japan final in 57. You notice that the gi that one of the women was wearing, he commented that it looked like she wore a size up to not get called. And it did look significantly bigger when he pointed that out. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see. I didn't pay too much attention to the grip fighting in these particular matches. I know in a general sense, I felt that the gripping between between the Paris Grand Slam and the previous Grand Prix event, I thought the gripping was a bit more livelier. But I would venture to guess that it's a lot easier for these athletes to grip certain areas of the gi these days.
Mm-hmm. I noticed there were a couple. They are enforcing these new rules. Like I saw Shido Wazari's for posting on the elbows and the hands. Yep. Yeah. One thing I had a note for that was I watched a match. I forget who it was, but he landed on one hand and then there was sort of a pause and then he landed on the other. And they didn't call a Wazari Shido. So it was kind of interesting that if you land at the same time with both hands back or both elbows back, for sure, that's a Shido Wazari.
Yeah.
But if you land on one and then the guy keeps driving you and then you transition to the other, it's kind of a gray area. So
yeah, I must have missed that. So as you know, I typically watch the final block of events, usually the gold medal matches and the bronze. There were some semifinal matches that I did watch on the first day, in particular with the under 66 and the under 73 kilo divisions. But so some of those things I tend to miss because I'm looking at other things, but I did not see that. I did notice that. I like the rule change. I know some of the athletes complained about it when they initially announced it. There's not even a technique name for it. I suppose you could call it Uchimata Tsukashi, where they step over the person attacking with Uchimata and they get them on their back. That they're not calling that a Wazari anymore. I did see some of that. I saw the refs not call it. And in one of the matches, and I know we're going to talk about it later, I've been maintaining since my last episode that, okay, it won't score now, but consider it a skillful entry into Nawaza. And that's exactly what I saw in one of the matches. I'll have to figure out which one it is, but I think it might've been one of the under 60 kilo bronze medal matches. But I do remember seeing that. So these days it's a skillful entry into Nawaza. And let me tell you, you brought up the reverse Sayanagi ban. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I trust that when they made these changes, it was for safety reasons. And given the past Grand Prix and the Grand Slam, this Paris Grand Slam, Korea hasn't been impacted one bit by that change. I mean, they've been a force so far in the early going of 2022. There've been plenty of medal matches, plenty of top seven finishes. They look like as strong as ever. So, you know, I know that that's been debated, but like you said, it's died down quite a bit. I haven't really heard too many people complain about it anymore because really they're still winning, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. For me personally, you know, I was taught reverse Sayanagi and it never worked for my game, but I definitely see the possibility for injury on it. I
mean, yeah.
You can be just dropped sort of on your head. And if you've watched highlights of reverse Sayanagi compilations, you'll see that sometimes, you know, they'll go straight on their head. And I can see that as a safety reason.
And not only that, on a left versus right situation, you know, with the right grip, if the guy doesn't get let go, that becomes an Uday Gurami throw, which I think that's kind of the angle they were going for, because if you have a throw that's an arm lock and they throw, they're going to be inclined to ban that because other arm locking throws have already been banned. So I've practiced that throw a number of times, but there's only been one guy that I've practiced it on, and I've only let one person practice it on me. I've never seen anybody even attempt it in Rondori against me. Nobody's ever done it on me. I've never once seen anybody even attempt reverse Sayanagi in any competition I've seen, like in person. No clinic that I've been to, no open mat that I've been to. I've never actually seen it. It's been a technique that I've really only seen at the higher levels of competition. I'm sure it's happened at the, you know, USA Judo Nationals and things like in higher level events. I don't doubt it. I'm just saying, in my own experience, I've never actually seen anybody pull it off. Not with my own eyes in front of me. Do you know anybody that has built a game around reverse Sayanagi?
I don't know about built a game around it, but you know, I've known people that had it in their repertoire.
You have? Okay.
So I don't think that they're, you know, devastated over this ban, but it was more, you know, if they get caught in left and right, it's a good attack.
Yeah. How do you feel about leg grabs these days? You still feel strongly about the?
I do.
You do. Yeah. Okay.
I think that's why Sambo speaks
Sambo.
To me.
Yeah.
It's to me, Sambo kind of exists as what judo should be, or what judo was, and what it lives on in Sambo. Yeah.
Yeah. I hear you. I hear you. I think I've softened my stance a little bit over the years. I'm okay with the ban at the IJF levels, but I think I've said it many times before, national levels and below, I think they should be there. I think they're good techniques, especially other techniques. Like I used to love doing traditional kata guruma. You know, you drop underneath a person, you know, and you throw them with that leg, you know, you grab that leg and you know, tilt them over. And I used to know a couple of people that had an excellent te guruma.
Yeah. That one's sad to have gone.
Yeah,
that was such a big throw.
Yeah, it really was, and I feel like I've because one of my best throws is Osotogari, and I feel like ever since that leg grab ban was put in place, I could go attack with Osoto all day, and without any fear of anybody grabbing that leg, you know, in a judo context anyway.
That's funny. I have a training partner who was a really good, you know, Osoto and Uchimata player who was lefty, and I was fighting righty at the time, and I felt like he could just hop on one leg and have his left leg out in front of me, and you know, there's not a lot I could do.
Yeah.
Because I know what's coming. It's going to be Uchimata or Osoto, but he could just hop towards me on the leg, and I felt like I couldn't get him, you know.
I hear you. So let's talk a little bit about the Paris Grand Slam and some of the matches. As you know, I like to run down the divisions. I did not see all of the divisions, but I want to start off with the under 48 kilo division. So what I'd like for you to do, Christian, is I run down some of the things that I saw. And if there's anything you want to chime in on, you know, feel free to do so. I'm probably going to stick more with the gold medal matches for the sake of time. But I will definitely cover as many in terms of who won, who, you know, who won the bronze medals and stuff. I will not cover who got fifth and seventh place. It's just too many. So the under 48 kilo division was gold medal match was between Bavudorj of Mongolia versus Tsunoda of Japan. Now, I don't know much about Bavudorj from Mongolia. It appears that she's a newcomer on the tour. Tsunoda of Japan is the 2021 world champion. I don't know if you saw this match, but I thought Tsunoda had a really great Tomonagi that she got the Awazari score. And I thought during this match that for as good of a day as Bavudorj had, her inexperience, I thought, was really showing against Tsunoda. It just seemed like, I don't know if she ran out of gas, but she just was, she got caught with the Tomonagi, and then she was thrown again for Tomonagi. There was no score there, but she was really, for a newcomer, it seemed like Tsunoda and her team had a game plan. Did you see anything in that match that stuck out to you?
Yeah. So I think for this division and for the two Japanese players that medaled, it was a lot of Neiwaza. And I know that there's, what's his name? The BJJ black belt. There's a Japanese BJJ black belt. I know that they had helping the Japanese women's team.
That's
and
right.
I think it's, yeah. The one that Hickson fought.
Yep.
I'm saying his name is Funaki, but I could be wrong. But I say I'm seeing that they're really, really good at Neiwaza. In the Bavador versus Tsunoda match, I saw what's called the kiss of the dragon position in jiu-jitsu. It's like, you know, if the guy is standing and I'm looking at his back and I'm seated and I can grab his belt and put my shins behind his behind the back of his knees and pull him into what's like the back.
Yeah,
they got to that position. Tsunoda got there, and I was just really impressed that she could get there because that's a sort of intricate jiu-jitsu position.
What else I saw too is that Tsunoda attacked Bavudorj with Ude Garami in her half guard. That was like, that reminded me of me. That's like one of my go-tos when I'm doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu. If somebody's got me in their half guard, I'm okay with that. I try and get an underhook and then I go for well, in jiu-jitsu, it's either the Americana or the Kimura. I'll do either or. But I rarely see that in judo. So I was very surprised to see that attack in that position. And the ref let it go. No mate. It was great to see.
Yeah, I think I saw that Ude Garami attack, and I think she used it to get Bavador to she had the attack, so she had to transition her focus away holding half guard. Yeah, that's how she got to the hold down.
That's how she got the Osaikomi. That's right. It's exactly that's what I saw as well. So Tsunoda ended up winning gold there in the bronze medal match. Koga of Japan defeated Melanie Clement Legu. She's going by Clement Legu now via Osaikomi as well. She got a Keisagatami. And Blandine Ponta, France, defeated Katharina Menz of Germany. Now, some of these names on the French team, France had 55 entrants into the Paris Grand Slam. I can't remember. I know that host countries can stack their divisions, but wow, they 55 competitors is a lot. So there's a lot of people in France that I've never even heard of that were competing in this tournament. Anything else in the under 48 kilo that stuck out to you?
Yeah. So it was the Pont versus Menz match.
Yeah.
I saw what to me looked like a head dive Uchimata. I think it was Pont. She landed on sort of the side of her head, not directly on like the top, but they let that go. That was fine. So
that's interesting because I saw another match. I believe it was one of the under 100 kilo matches where they called a Hansuki Maki on that, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah. Okay?
What's that?
I was wondering, like, is that okay? Or is it just, warm getting used to this new rule?
Well, in that match, they called the Hansukumaki. They it seems like they with the new rule changes, they're going to enforce that even more. So I'm guessing, because I don't really see a lot of head diving on the IGF tour a lot. I mean, I see a lot of inadvertent stuff, but I'm guessing maybe they're really clamping down on these rules because of the juniors and cadets in those divisions. I don't watch those, the cadet world championships or the junior world championships, not for any reason. It's just most of the time it's happening while I'm working. And I just,
to me, it looked like in the vein of like an Ono, Shohei Ono style Uchimata, where he really like puts his head down and throws.
Yeah.
Which to me, I think would be illegal with these new rules.
I would think so too. I didn't see that match, the under 48 kilo bronze match with Pont. So I'm not sure. I would have to watch the replay on that and see exactly what she did.
I had one more note for 48.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
A great match. Koga versus Sonoda. Like I saw that one of the players took the back standing and then went for an armbar, like not a flying armbar, but she climbed onto the other person's back,
like
then
hooks in and everything.
Bar. Yeah, it was really interesting to see. And then so she fell off of the armbar position, and the other person stood up, and I can only say it was like a tripod sweep, because you know. She hooked the leg and the other person was standing, which I would imagine is illegal, since we've talked about the Ryan Vargas rule in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. At least my nickname, Ryan Vargas rule. Yeah. Throwing the, you know, taken down when you're on the ground and throwing in that sense.
But there were two standing armbar transitions in that match, I think. And there was some single leg X type control. So it was really interesting to watch as a Neiwaza person.
Yeah, I saw another match where I saw single leg X. I was like, okay, and it was, I believe it was one of the Japanese ladies. I saw that. I was like, oh, look at that. I was just practicing that the other night. So I was like,
I think they must have said to allow for more ground time, because I took my stopwatch in one of these matches and I had 13 seconds of someone on the back in Neiwaza. And to me, you know, once someone gets in the back in a sort of jujitsu way, they're calling mate.
It depends on the ref, but you're right. I've seen the it seems like I mean I hate saying things like that, but it seems like sometimes the referees have a bias with when the Japanese do Neiwaza, they will generally allow for more time. Or they will generally allow them to set up their positions than when I see with other people. It could be specific referee bias. You know, maybe the referees know a little, are in the know a little bit more, even though these referees are the best in the world. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you have your own biases with what you want a match to look like. I think that can creep in. It creeps in any sport. I can't imagine judo would be any exception to that.
Because I know in one of the tournaments they held here, they told at the referee seminar that the referee, where they gathered the referees before the tournament, they said to allow for more Neiwaza time.
Yeah. I think that's a good thing. Yeah. I think that's a good thing. You know, unless somebody's got full guard and they're just sitting there not doing anything, you know, I think you got to allow for some action. So moving on to the under 60 kilo division, it was the final was between Nagayama of Japan versus Jeon Sungbom of Korea. Now I'm sure you saw the highlight of this, but halfway through the match,
I saw it. Yeah,
Jeon crawled for his life to get out of bounds. He would have made a Marine Corps private crawling on the barbed wire envious the way that he crawled off of that mat to get the Shido. So I'm assuming that perhaps he had a specific game plan, and part of that game plan was do not enter Neiwaza with Nagayama.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting that they called Shido for it. I never thought that, you know, actively escaping, because we saw it back in the day. That's how you got out of a hold down. You could just kind of scoot out and they would stop it. But I didn't put two and two together that, you know, if you flee on the ground and you go over the line, you would get a going over the line Shido.
Yeah, I've not seen anybody do that ever, at least on the IGF World Tour. But the ref made the right call. I mean, basically, they deliberately stepped out of bounds, and instead of stepping, it crawled like a snake on the ground. But you know, or like an infantryman, you know, hiding from bullets going over his head or something. That was very impressive when he ran out. But with 45 seconds left to go in the match, Nagayama counters John Sanagi with, I guess, what I would call a Daki Wakari for Wazari. And he continued with the Osaikomi for the Wazari Awaseti Ippon. So pretty lively match. I thought that was the highlight of the match, crawling off the mat. Anything else that stuck out to you in that match?
In that match, no, I think Ryuji looked on point whole tournament. Yeah.
In the bronze medal match, you had Papineshvili of Georgia against Huseynov of Azerbaijan. And I got to tell you, I don't know if you saw this match, but Huseynov had a throw 14 seconds into the match that I thought it was a beautiful Sayanagi. I thought it was worthy of an Ippon, and he didn't get it. And Papineshvili in this match ends up getting the Ippon with a brilliant Kouchigari. And it was a fantastic match for me, but boy, I really felt that Huseynov was screwed here, because he could have won that match 14 seconds into that fight. And I felt like and we talked about this prior to recording, that it almost seems like the standard for Ippon in some of these matches has been raised again, because there's some matches that I thought, wow, that's an Ippon, and they ended up giving a Wazari. I'm not so sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing yet, but I just thought it was really interesting to see. Did you manage to catch this match at all?
I did. Yeah. So I thought that Papineshvili had a great tempo, a great pace in that match.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah. He really took it to the Azeri. I do think that Papineshvili's throw at the end was a bit of a poor landing for an Ippon score.
You thought so? Okay.
I thought so, yeah. Like the first Huseynov's throw, that one was pretty good, yeah. I think it was definitely on the side.
You did think it was side. Okay, yeah. You thought it was more on the side. Okay.
But, you know, for this other throw to be called Ippon, I think was not quite sure. I wouldn't have called it. Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm at. I felt the Ippon Sayanagi by Huseynov had a better landing than the Ippon that Papineshvili got with his Kouchigari. So that's kind of how I saw it. But again, you know, I'm not here to dog the refs. They're the best in the world. I think they do a good job almost all of the time. So I tend to give them the benefit of the doubt, but I pretend for me, I thought that might've been a miss, but you said you thought he landed more on the side.
Yeah.
Okay. Now in the other bronze medal match, you had Lee Harim of Korea against Luca Mikidze of France. And I have a note here that the exchange with 2:44 left in the contest was really fascinating to me. Mihitse wins with a Juju Katami after not scoring on the attack. And this is one of these instances where I saw one of those continuation rules with the Uchimata, with that step over rule that used to score. And now they're not scoring anymore. But I've always been saying with that rule that okay, well, you're not going to score anymore, but this is considered a skillful entry into Nawaza. And I think that's exactly what Luca did here. And he got that Juju Katami. And did you happen to see that match at all?
I did, yeah. I think if you watch any of the Paris Grand Slam, go ahead and do yourself a favor and watch all of Mikidze's matches. He did a fantastic job. Like normally when I think of minus 60, I think of Takato's kind of judo where it's bent over. It's not that exciting, but he really impressed me. In the match with the armbar, I watched his judo. I thought his sort of kataguruma slash sort of like a wrestling duck under that Moloai likes to do I think that was really exciting. Did a really good job. Yeah.
So you saw Mikitse's matches all throughout this division. Did you watch the semifinals and stuff? What did you think? Anything stand out to you on the semifinals for the under 60?
I think the one where he faced the other Georgian was that's a must watch match. It was sort of Georgian power, and at one point Mikitse gets an omoplata, and Mikitse escapes by lifting him up off the floor, and the pace was great. It was really interesting. Yeah. And there's the power throw, the Yuguri Nage like hip thigh throw is going around on Instagram.
I did see
the Georgian hit that on Mikitse, but Mikitse survives that to go on and win the match. And that's, you know, not to give away the match, but you know, that's worth a watch for sure.
Yeah, I've seen that clip go around. I didn't realize that was Mikitse there.
Yeah. So he survived that and goes on, does an omoplata. It was great. I have to say, yeah.
Now, moving on to the under 66 kilo division, the final. One of my favorites in this division, An Bao of Korea against Yeondeon Peuraleni of Mongolia. Really tight match. I just thought both of these fighters were very even. An Bao had Tushido going into golden score for two false attacks. I felt that Yeondeon Peuraleni was a little bit defensive, and I thought he got away with a lot of non-Shido calls for being defensive. And later on in golden score, about 3 minutes into golden score, they finally called a Shido on both fighters. But it ended up costing An Bao the match, so which was very surprising to me. They both had sleeve grips. They didn't really do anything. They were standing around there. So it makes me wonder if the Mongolian had a specific game plan with his coach on how to, because I've always said there's five ways to win in judo, and one of those ways is winning by Shido. So it almost seemed like they had a game plan to get An Bao the Shido into losses. Did you see this match at all?
I thought it was interesting. Like, I imagine seeing An Bao fight before, they both looked pretty flat in the match. I don't know if it was because they're both great players and they kind of neutralize each other. But
yeah,
I remember watching Peuraleni in the Olympics, and I thought he did great. I know he didn't medal, but this double Shido for a gold was a bit disappointing.
Yeah.
I have to say. Yeah.
Yeah. I never liked seeing that, but I thought it was the right call, but by the ref. I thought the ref could have called a Shido on the Mongolian before that point in golden score. But it didn't happen. I did not see any other matches in the under 66 kilo division. Did you catch anything else?
Yeah, I think the Tanaka versus the Finnish player, that wasn't the best, a bit disappointing.
Yeah.
But the Georgian versus the Frenchman Buba, that was great. That was a great another Georgian, what I would call a Yagura Nage, the front thigh lifting throw from chest to chest. Yeah, that's a throw to see for sure. One note I had for this division, I saw a couple American players. Ari Berliner before in this division, but a newcomer, Isaiah Ramirez,
he ended up getting seventh.
Mm-hmm. He impressed me. I liked his style. I think he might be one to watch for us Americans, you know.
I hope so, because I tell you what, seventh place at the Paris Grand Slam is nothing to sneeze at. That should be celebrated. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, we should be celebrating that here, because that's a big deal. That's a huge finish. You got to, Team USA has got to get themselves into top seven finishes. And this is, you know, you start here. I mean, boy, I mean, that division is stacked. I don't know anything about Ramirez's game. I didn't see him fight. I only saw the result, But yeah, I'm going to go back and watch some of his matches. Boy, this division's tough. But to get seventh with these fighters in here, and I don't know who represented from Japan. I know Abe was not here, but that's a tough division.
Yeah. I was wondering who – I've seen this the coach for the USA. I've seen him in other tournaments. I think he's the guy from Florida. I don't know his name. Do you know who's in the coach's chair?
Johnny Prado?
Yeah.
It might be one. Johnny Prado from Kiyotusai, I believe. Yeah, yeah. It should be Kiyotusai. That's one of the national training centers in the United States, along with let's see. Yeah, out in California, you got where Mike Swain teaches. Goodness, where is that? At the college. I totally draw. Oh, San Jose State. Yeah, San Jose State.
That makes sense.
Got Colorado Springs. I think Jason Morris is, and I think Jimmy Pedro's as well. I think. I'm not sure if that's considered a national training site anymore, but probably should be. Hmm. All right, so moving on to the under 73 kilo final between Lasha Shadatuitsvili, who's one of my favorites to watch, against Hashimoto of Japan. Went into golden score, and both Shadatuitsvili and Hashimoto are really getting away with a lot of grip breaking and not advancing. This is one of those situations where I like the new rule where you got to be advancing if you're going to grip break. But I saw a lot of grip breaking and resetting, and I thought the ref might have been asleep at the wheel a little bit, because they could have easily been called a couple of shidos there. But I guess when you've got these two guys, you don't want the referee to decide the outcomes. And I think the referees in finals, they understand that. They don't want to, nobody watches judo to see the referees ref. So I do appreciate it when they let the fighters fight, but Hashimoto ends up getting a third shido, and which is, he ends up with the Hansoku Maki. So Shavdatuishvili ends up getting gold there.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Got your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
What did you think of that match?
I think Shatashu has really, really put pressure on Hashimoto, like in regulation. And then you saw momentum kind of shift to Hashimoto. But I think I heard in the commentary that I agreed with. I think Shatuashvili played tired at the end because Hashimoto had two shidos and Shatuashvili only had one. Yeah. He played tired, and Hashimoto, his momentum was going, and he was, you know, being imposing. So I think Hashimoto kind of played with him a bit, and that cost him with not really attacking. Like there were some movements where I think Hashimoto was like, he had his chest out and he just let the guy kind of fall off of him. I think Shatuashvili played tired to get him to overcommit to not attacking and get the third Cheeto.
Interesting.
That was my interpretation.
No,
that's what Sheldon said as well.
Yeah, I hear you. Now, I only saw one of the under 73 kilo bronze medal matches, and that was between Fabio Basile of Italy versus Benjamin Axis of France. I tell you what, Basile looked like he was giving up a foot. I can't believe that Axis is fighting in the under 73 kilo division at that height. It's almost looking at Daria Bilo did in the under 48 kilo division, where she's seemingly a foot taller than everybody else. One thing that I thought was really odd about Basile's fighting in this contest, and I saw a semifinal where he kind of did the same thing. He's a lefty fighter, but he was fighting, doing a lot of righty techniques, but he looked like a lefty fighter pretending to be righty at some times. And it cost him in this match, in my opinion. I mean, Basile went in for, I want to say was a, I thought it was an Ouchigari Basile went in for a right sided attack and he got countered big time. And I don't know if you managed to see that at all, but I was very surprised at Basile going from right to left so frequently.
Yeah, I saw that one, and that was another must watch match, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was really exciting to say the least. Yeah, absolutely.
Because, yeah. Axis was so tall, and he was the tall lefty versus Fabio Basile. Who I think he usually likes to play far. He likes to throw kataguruma from sort of not being so in close to do like harai, but he likes those katagurumas. He likes his kosotos from far. And
yeah.
I think that Axis being so tall and also a lefty, I think that really threw him off. So I think Axis is probably going to be one to watch because it said that he came in, 214th in the world at this weight class.
Yeah. Yeah.
To beat Fabio Basile.
That's a big deal. That's a big win.
So, but credit to Fabio Basile for escaping mount from this guy. Yep. That was an incredible escape.
Yeah.
I have to look at that again and put that into my repertoire because that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Completely agreed. Now, I want to switch over to the which is my favorite division to watch on the tour, the under 52 kilo division, which to me just continues to be one of the most exciting divisions on the tour. And this final in this setting is no exception with Amadine Bouchard versus Dmitrij Krasniqi of Kosovo. You can't ask for better in this division. Krasniqi is up a weight class after winning gold at the Olympics from the under 48 kilo division. So I believe this might have been her second. I think she was at the Grand Prix a couple of weeks ago. So this is her second match in the under 52 kilo division. Bouchard is the current number one in the world, and she won silver at the Olympics. Just really exciting match heading into Golden Score. Bouchard gets a Wazari at around the 355 mark in Golden Score. I wasn't sure about that particular call, but I didn't think, because with the new Wazari rule, which I like, the body's got to be at least 90 degrees and back facing toward the mat. I wasn't sure about that Wazari call that she got, but on the replay, I thought it was close enough. So, she probably got the home count call a little bit there. But the continuation on that throw was, I suppose, got to the 90 degrees. Either way, the crowd goes wild. It was a tremendous match for me. What did you think?
That was another one of the ones I had starred as a must watch.
Yeah,
it was so technical. I really like Bouchard's game, and I have a lot written here about this match because I thought there was a lot in terms of the stylistic differences between Bouchard and Krasniqi. I think it was really, really interesting that Bouchard fought righty against lefties, but normally fights lefty against righties. Krasniqi really likes to be in close and hit Osoto's, Harai's, and Uchibata's. But you saw her struggle in the match against Chelsea Giles earlier on, who fought for bronze in 52. You saw her really struggle. And I think that's because, you know, Chelsea Giles is lanky, tall, and Bouchard also likes to play sort of far, kind of like Giles. So I think, like, the score that Krasniqi got against Giles, I think, was questionable. I think she only really kind of barely beat her. So for her to come into this, I think Bouchard was a big, big challenge.
Yeah. And I think Krasniqi will eventually get her. She's already, you know, next division up, she's already in a final of one of the biggest competitions of the year. So I think Krasniqi will get over on Bouchard at some point during the year. I'm sure they'll rematch again, you know, maybe at the World Championships and such. But yeah, I love watching Bouchard. I think she's just phenomenal. She, between her and Clarisse Agbignenu, I mean, that women's team for France is just unbelievable to me. They're just so much fun to watch.
I'm looking forward to seeing her in Paris. One thing I noted here, a technique that I think was so interesting that Bouchard does. So she fights lefty against righties, right? And so she'll post with her right hand for the right collar, and then she'll go for a kataguruma to that side. So normally in left and right, you can do kind of the Fabio Basile kataguruma, which is to the left side. So if you're holding the left collar as a lefty, you'd go to that side, but she goes to the far side with the right collar. And it's like in like freestyle wrestling, if you shot to the other leg to do kataguruma on the far side. And I just think that was so interesting to watch. And you know, Bouchard also has great Nawaza.
Nawaza between her and Abe at the Olympics. I mean, that was a clinic to me. I mean, that was also a fantastic match.
Bouchard had hit another one of those right far katagrumas in a way that I learned a trick from watching Molai. If you're a righty and you come out crouched, a lot of people won't notice you suddenly explode up and get your posture and go for an overhand.
So
Bouchard did that against the Japanese fighter, and she hit the kataguruma that she liked. And I think that was an amazing, amazing display of judo.
Yeah, she's tremendous. I did not watch the other matches in the under 52 kilo division. Was there any other matches that you wanted to comment on?
Just that I saw that in the other bronze medal match in the Neto versus Kosher, that they are calling the breaking a grip and not retaking a grip. I saw that Shido in that match.
You did? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did see that in other matches. It did, but some of the ones that I watched, I'm surprised they didn't call it.
And then one interesting technique I saw from the Japanese fighter, Shishime, was she was attempting Hanegoshi in a left versus right against Chelsea Giles, who's quite large or quite tall. And, you know, she was in that V shape in left and right, and she cut across to hit Hanegoshi to the far leg. I thought that was really interesting.
Now, are you sure it was Hanegoshi and not Uchimata?
She did like a spring with Chelsea Giles to me looked a lot like a kind of a Daria Billa did, because she's so tall in this division.
Yeah.
But I think, and I see her do a lot of Nawaza, a lot of turtle Sankaku attacks. I just think that maybe Chelsea Giles needs a little bit more throwing ability, kind of that Daria has.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see Giles versus Daria.
Now, moving on to the under 81 kilo final, Tato Grigalishvili of Georgia against Fujiwara Sotaro of Japan. And again, this was one of those matches where I was stunned. The Seinagi by Sotaro by Fujiwara was called a wazari. That, to me, that was an ippon. And a few seconds later after that, Grigalishvili gets a wazari with a Tewaza type throw. I'm not sure what you would call it, some sort of pickup. I would either, it's one of those, you could call it a Teguruma, you could call it an Uki, a competitive version of Uki Otoshi. I'm not sure what to call it, but boy, the finish of this match was incredible for me. I thought for sure that Grigaliashvili was going to get the Uchimata with that behind the back grip, but Fujiwara reversed it for a Kosoda Gari. Just a fantastic match within the regulation period that didn't go into golden score with just plenty of action. What did you think of this one?
I think that was another good one. You know, I think that Senagi was what could have been a pawn.
Okay, yeah, so I'm not a man on an island there. Okay.
Yeah, I do think that having the match go on allowed for me to watch better judo, so I'm not so mad about it. But
oh, sure, yeah.
But I thought one thing that impressed me about Grigaliashvili was I think he looked really good on the ground. Like I don't necessarily associate Georgians with Newaza, but you know, he had good movement.
Yeah, that's a good observation. See, that's funny. I'm glad you're on, because there's things that I don't cover that you're covering here. So that's an aspect of it that I completely didn't, blew right over. But you're right. I mean, there was some excellent display of Nawaza there for sure. Did you watch any other matches in the under 81 kilo division that you wanted to cover?
I watched the Sagimuki versus Chuchi match. I think they had a good match, but overall
I saw that. Muki lost that, right?
Yeah, he lost that.
Okay, I did see it. I just didn't make any notes on it.
And then the other one, because I'd been watching Gauthier Drapeau, the Canadian, because we had a new 81 kilo Canadian player on the world tour. And he made it all the way for the bronze medal match against Boltaboyev. I think he did good. I think, Antoine Valois-Fortier did a good job training this guy, because he looks, he moves in a sort of similar way. He's kind of lanky and tall like Antoine Valois-Fortier.
Yeah.
And it was, I think it was in one of his matches that I saw that Gauthier posted on one hand and then went to the other, but didn't get called Shido.
Now, I'm a little surprised that Judo Canada did not send more athletes to this particular Grand Slam. This is one of the biggest ones of the year. I think they only sent two athletes.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the reasoning was for that, but I see on Instagram that, you know, the other, like, Jessica Klimklate and Shadi El-Nahas is training. So
yeah. Maybe they have a game plan on certain tournaments that they want to target, which is perfectly understandable. I mean, I think the world of what Canada has going up there. Did you hear my interview with Josh Hagen?
Was that
athletes? No, that Josh Hagen is the head coach for the Northwest Territories for Judo Canada.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And I interviewed him back after the Olympics. It was late last year. It's a really fascinating interview, and it's just really interesting to hear just Canada's structure and how they're running their national team. I know the funding, the national funding is different than it is for the United States, but Canada gets the money, and they're getting, because of that, they get the results.
Yeah.
And they had a good, like you just pointed out, they had a good showing, a newcomer, and boom, he's fighting for a medal.
It was interesting to see with the Instagram training. I saw someone from our local judo scene here in BC. If you're good as a young person, you get sent, you move your way up to the provincial team.
Yeah.
And then if you're good enough, you'll be asked to move to the National Training Center in Quebec. So we've had a few people over the years go there, but I've seen on the Instagram that one of the guys I knew from here is training with Shadi and I know he fights in his weight class. So it's good to see that as well.
That's good. I think, mm-hmm. I think the way Canada does it, and I'm probably going to get some backlash for this or whatever, having all the athletes go to one place is, I think, is the best way. I think that's how most other countries do it. I don't know if having so many different national training centers is the way to go for USA Judo. That, just my opinion. I don't, just from what I see, I don't know of any other judo country, serious judo country around the world that does it that way. And I know geographically the United States is a pretty big place, but so is Canada geographically. It's a huge land area. So, you know, they managed to pull it off, you know, in one location. So just my opinion, I don't know if it would help matters. I don't know if it would hurt, but I think part of Judo Canada's success is having all the athletes in one place.
I do think that would have some growing pains. Like, I know.
Oh, for sure.
Original judo podcast, what was his name? James Austin. He's talked a lot about that. And that was sort of,
that was an issue in the UK. Yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. That was eye opening. It's still a debate if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So, you know, individual people's struggles is valid, but I think that, you know, a national training center probably seems to be the way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I now, did think that
yeah, please.
There's a absence of Russian athletes, at least a few of them. Like they didn't send out like a bunch of people. Like weirdly, Mongolia sent out a bunch of people. Canada didn't really send out a bunch. It's a strange Paris Grand Slam, but
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. To me, the Paris Grand Slam is one of those events. It's the second largest event, it's second biggest event next to the World Championships on any given year when it's not an Olympic year. So I was surprised to see, you know, certain countries not send, you know, full teams to this event. Maybe there's pandemic concerns still. Maybe there's issues with regards, you know, other types of issues that I'm not aware of, but you know, Paris to me kicks off the calendar year, even though there was a Grand Prix a week before it. But to me, you know, it's kind of like I vaguely follow NASCAR. You know, the Daytona 500 kicks off the entire year. It's the biggest race of the year, and that, you know, all the drivers show up for that, and that's really the only race that I watch. But I kind of see the Paris Grand Slam in a similar way.
Could I make a note on the 73? I forgot to.
Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah.
So with the 73 with Axius, it was really interesting to see that he beat round one Orzhov, and then he beat.
Orzhov? Did he really?
Yeah. He beat Orzhov in round one. Yeah. So that's why I had the note. He's someone to watch for sure.
Yeah. Wow. That's a big win. I know you had a hell of a day, but still. Yeah.
Another interesting thing with an Azerbaijani athlete, with Haydarov, the hair guy. He lost to an athlete from the Gambia, which, you know, not exactly a judo country.
Right.
But, you know, anything can happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
And I learned in some of the commentary, I didn't know that the IGF announcer is Georgian, the guy with the deep voice. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I think that was interesting to learn.
Huh.
And I when I was listening to some of the individual matches on the IGF live website, which is great.
It really is great. I used to watch it on YouTube. But somebody on Reddit was like, what the hell are you doing? You should be watching through the IGF. So I've been doing it ever since that guy told me that. And yeah, that person was right, because it's superior to watch it through the IGF portal.
But I could hear in the IGF portal, you can hear the French commentary.
Yeah.
And one thing, you know, as a Spanish speaker, and I took a semester in high school of French, that the French commentary uses a lot of, I would call it Spanglish, but, you know, it's French. The French use a lot of English words sort of haphazardly. And I thought it was pretty funny. Yeah. Uh-huh. That was really funny to listen to, actually.
It's interesting you bring that up because I have heard French commentary in the past. And to me, you know, because there's a lot of words that English words that come from French words and such. If I know the context of what's being talked about, let's say judo, for example, I can kind of follow what's being said. It's not hard for me to pick it up. And I think it's part of because I'm somewhat bilingual with Spanish and English. I can kind of connect the dots with other languages. I can't do that with a language like Japanese, but you know, listening to German and listening to French, I can kind of, if I understand the context, I can kind of pick up on what's being said.
I noticed on one of the American athletes in 73, they were wearing I don't know if you've ever heard of Ippon gear, but it looked like it had a Fuji logo and the American was wearing it. I Googled it just now and apparently it's a Hatashida Sports IGF approved gi. It was really interesting. I'd never seen that gi before.
Interesting. Yeah. I didn't notice. I didn't see him fight.
But as far as I'm aware, the Fuji brand doesn't have a IGF approved gi. But I thought it was interesting. Yeah, I don't think they do.
Huh. Okay.
It's not like a Matsuru or other sort of smaller brand that do.
Yeah, I'm in the market. I got to get myself a new judo gi soon, and I want to make sure that it's IJF approved. Not that I'll ever sniff an IJF tournament, but I would like to have something that's official. You know, I have a single weave that I use. It's my old trusty dependable single weave. It's comfortable, but I need a new gi at some point. So, all right. So moving on to the under 70 kilo final. Featuring Margot Pinault of France against Nisoi Saki of Japan. For me, in this match, both competitors look really tired. I don't know what their road up to this final looked like, but they look like a couple of fighters that fought a lot of Golden Score matches. And this particular match ended up in Golden Score. Pinault ends up getting a Sayanagi. That was the slowest continuation Sayanagi maybe in judo history that I have ever seen anyway. I thought at first that there were two movements and that should not have called the Wazari there. But when I saw the replay, it was a continuous one movement, but just a really slow movement. Crowd goes wild as usual for the French, which I got to say, part of the reason why I love the Paris Grand Slam is you got 14,000 plus people, you know, piled up into an arena and they all know judo and they really support their athletes. Did you see this competition? I don't know if this was the division that you watched.
No, I wasn't able to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. Completely understood. This was the only final that I saw. I did not watch any of the under 70 kilo matches. The under 70 kilo and the under 57 kilo divisions are not ones. There's some divisions that I will set my alarm to watch, and other ones that I'll just catch the replay. And this under 70, I don't typically, you know, set an alarm to watch. But I did see this final. I want to move on to the under 90 kilo division. The gold medal final featured Moraro. I don't know if I got that right, of Japan. Against Mamadali Mediev of Azerbaijan. And we talked about this before we started recording. I'm really surprised. This is another one of those throws that Osotogari that by Morao did not score any pawn. I said it before, I'll say it again. There's a few throws in this tournament that I really thought by my standards, I thought was, which I think are pretty high, worry pawn, and it was called a Wazari. And again, looked like one of those things where maybe the refs as a whole have raised the standard of repawn. But it was a double sleeve Osotogari, which I love seeing because I do it all the time. What did you think of this particular match? Moraro ended up winning.
I think it was a great match. You know, Moraro looked spectacular. I think that to that match, even in that match, that Mihaidayev also looked great. You know, I've watched Mihaidayev in tournaments in the past, and I really like watching him. I think he's an interesting player to watch.
Azerbaijan's got an awesome team. They've had awesome. They have such great judoka.
The only other note I had for this division was not for the bronze medal matches, but for the other interesting player that I have seen in other tournaments and also in this tournament, which I was surprised he didn't do better, was Christian Parletti, the Italian. Oh, he's such an unorthodox player. If you get the chance, look up, if you can find a highlight or watch some of his matches, he does really interesting drop ochigakes that just don't look like they should work, but they do.
But they do?
Yeah, it's really interesting, yeah.
Who is that again?
Christian Parletti.
I'll check him out after we're done recording. I'll take a look, because I'm not familiar with him. Mm-hmm.
I think he like takes a page out of Fabio Basile's book and doing strange waza, but it's great.
Now, moving on to the under 78 kilo final, that was with Umeki Mami of Japan versus Audrey Tremeo of France. Now, near the beginning of the match, Tremeo gets a sumigayeshi, which I thought was going to be any pawn, but they awarded a wazari. Again, it went to video review. And then Tremeo ends up getting another throw that went to video review, but it wasn't a wazari. It seemed like Tremeo was really pushing Umeki this entire match. He was really dominant. And, you know, towards the end, Umeki seems to finally get going and, you know, nearly gets a choke there. But Tremeo ends up shidoing her way to a gold medal. Did you see this under 78 kilo division at all?
I wasn't able to catch it, but okay. I like Tremeo. I think she's a really good player.
I do too. Yeah, I like watching the under 78 kilo division, and she's one of the top players that I enjoy watching. That, like I said before, that Team France is just amazing as well. We stack it out there with Japan, Azerbaijan, you know, Russia. I mean, Brazil. I didn't see much of Brazil in this in any of the time. I don't even know if they showed up in this tournament.
I remember something where it was like something live with Neil Adams, and I had a friend who interviewed Neil Adams for his podcast, and I got him to ask a question to Neil. I asked him, like, why is the Brazilian team not doing as well as we had seen in the past? And Neil Adams didn't agree with me, but, you know, I don't see their athletes making the top medals anymore. I feel like they're in the bronzes, but there's no solid Brazilian athlete, I think, that's getting golds, you know?
I just think the competition is so tight up in those, you know, the top seven in any division is just so hard. You could almost make the same case for Canada in a way, where I think a lot of their athletes are so strong and they're just, the competition is just so tight between Canada and Brazil. But I mean, I hear what you're saying. I don't know if they're any weaker. It's just, I think it just comes down to a matter of inches and just, you know, just some days it's just not their day. You know what I mean? It just seems like it hasn't been their day it seems like it's been not their day more often, I should say.
Yeah.
Now, moving on to the plus 78 kilo final. Did you watch plus 78s at all?
I didn't, no.
So in this final, it featured Tomita Wakaba of Japan against Romain Dico of France. And now Tomita won this. I'm not sure what you call what she won with, but it was really impressive throw. It kind of looked like a weird version of Daki Wakari again. It's the second time I saw that throw used as a score, but it was just really odd. Deco went in for some kind of a throw, and usually I see Daki Wakari when somebody does a Seinagi and they fail, but and it's countered with Daki Wakari. But in this instance, it almost looked like she did it while Romain Deco was standing up. It's a really impressive throw. I don't really watch all that much plus 78 kilo matches, but this particular final was one of the best I've seen in a while in that division, quite frankly. So I didn't, but that was the only match of the plus 78 kilo that I watched. So because you didn't watch it, we can move on to another division.
Yeah.
The under 100 kilo division final between Toma Nikiforov of Belgium against Peter Palchik of Israel. Really lively match to me heading into Golden Score. Palchik got slammed on his face in the early going within the first couple of seconds, and he had to be bandaged up. I guess he was bleeding from his nose. It's funny. It's funny how they bandage guys up in the, on the IGF. It's almost like they go above and beyond what they really need. But yeah, he had bandages wrapped around his face, around his nose. And Palchik ended up getting called for a Hansoku Maki. This is the one I was talking about before, for head diving. And looking at the replay, to me, it was absolutely the right call. You got to call that head dive. Did you see this match?
You know, I didn't catch it, but I think I'd seen on Instagram a highlight of this.
Okay.
You know, I like watching Peter Palchik, but... yeah.
In the under 100 kilo bronze medal matches, the medals in these in that division went to Turoboyev of Uzbekistan defeating Michael Correll of the Netherlands. Just kind of a surprise for me because on the IJF portal you can vote for who you think is going to win, and I voted for Correll on that one. He ended up losing, and Ida Kentaro of Japan defeated Buscarini of Brazil with a really nice Uchimata. Okay, there you go, Brazil. Yeah, so Brazil did make it to a medal match, but he ended up getting fifth there.
I did see Nicolau, or the Spanish Georgian guy, the world champion at 90.
Oh, that's right. He moved up a weight. I forgot about that.
I watched his matches. He had two.
How did he look?
He looks like your average everyday Joe in that weight class. He doesn't look like the towering, dominating figure that we know him in 90. It was really interesting to see, especially when he fought another really tall, like even taller than Shiraz Yazvili. He fought a guy who was even taller. And I think that was just threw him off, you know, watching that match. So. Well, I have if this is his right weight class or not.
No,
he didn't look spectacular.
Are you talking about Shiraz Dishvili, Nicole Shiraz Dishvili of Spain?
Yeah.
I think I read, and maybe I'm thinking of somebody else, but I thought I read an article on the IJF site where he decided to move up a weight class because it was just too difficult for him to stay at under 90 kilo. He said... I think I read that he'd been hungry all the time for years. I mean, so it's kind of funny that you say that he kind of looks like an average Joe. I think he'd been really struggling with keeping that weight in his former division. So this is going to be interesting. Talking about Dystria Kresnicki moving up in weight class, I think she's going to do fine there. I think Daria Bilo did. There's been some rumors that she's going to bump up from under 48 to under 52 kilo division, which if she does, I mean, that division is just going to get even better. But unlike Dystria Krasniqi and unlike, who I just mentioned, I'm just drawing a blank all of a sudden, Daria Bilo did. I think that it's going to take Nicole Sheriff Dishvili a little bit to get used to under 100 kilo. He's going to have a tough transition, I think.
You saw that with Kripalik when he first went up to plus 100.
That's right.
Even at the end, he wasn't really consistently winning golds.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Agreed.
But, you know, he's the plus 100 champion.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Now I'm going to cover real quickly some of the other divisions that I missed. Well, I did see, I skipped over the under 63 kilo final. I did watch it. It was an All Japan final with Nabikuro defeating Doi. And I'm not familiar with Doi as a fighter, but apparently, you know, looking at her record, she's had some really nice wins in the last Olympic cycle with a few Grand Slams and a Grand Prix. Sometimes I watch these matches and I know I cover them all, but sometimes I just forget the fighters because I'm concentrating on other fighters in that division. Clearly, Clarissa Agbegnenu was not in this division. And I said it many times before, I set alarms to watch Clarice fight. She's my favorite judoka on the tour, but she's pregnant. She announced it a few days ago on her Instagram. So it makes sense why she didn't compete in this Paris Grand Slam. She stated that she's fully intending on competing at the 2024 games, but I have to believe she's going to take at least a year and a half off. That still should give her some time to get enough points to make a final or to get enough points to make it to the Olympics. But yeah, so she's pregnant. Congratulations to her and her, I think she's married. I don't know if she's married or fiance, but I know her fiance is her coach, or one of her coaches. So congratulations to both of them. I think that's really great. Did you watch any of the under 63 at all?
Yeah, I watched her matches or the final and then the bronzes.
Okay.
I'd say the overall, it was kind of, I hate to say this, but like a boring division.
Yeah.
But it was another Shido final for gold. Yep. With a Japan versus Japan.
Yeah.
For gold. Which, like that happened at 57.
I see that a lot.
And that happened at 63.
It happens a lot. At least it feels like it happens a lot when there's an All Japan final at one of these tournaments. So let's see. I completely missed the under 57 kilo division, which was, again, another All Japan final between Funakobu and Tamaoki. And Funakobu was the winner of that. I also missed the plus 100 kilo division. Did you watch any of those divisions?
I watched 57.
You did?
And
any thoughts on that?
It was another third Shido Hansogomaki gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Suzuki, the All France bronze medal match was interesting. You know, Suzuki is good all around. I think that, you know, I see signs of like Clarissa Agbegnenu kind of good all around.
Yeah.
But Suzuki, when Suzuki lost to the eventual gold medalist Funakobu, you could just see that Funakobu had just edged her out in Neiwaza, because you know, Suzuki got some Neiwaza wins in this tournament, but Funakobu pinned Suzuki for Ippon.
Now, what about the plus 100 kilo division? Did you watch that at all?
I didn't, no.
Okay, yeah, I missed it as well. You know, it's tough for me sometimes when these tournaments land because it was on the plus 100 kilo division was on a Sunday. And there's a lot of things I end up doing at home on Sunday. Housework and things like that. I had it on early in the morning, but the plus 100 kilo division was the last matches of the day. And we're talking about, like, you know, past noon for me. And after that, when everybody's up and stuff, I'm just done. I got other things going on. Thankfully it was this did not happen on Super Bowl weekend, because I love the NFL. So, but the plus 100 kilo division was won by Otku of Mongolia, who defeated Kokoruri of Azerbaijan. Again, another Azerbaijani in a final. It just in a medal match. So pretty impressive there. Wanted to cover the medal count. Despite France entering 55 competitors, was still won by Japan, who took 7 gold medals, 5 silver medals, and 6 bronze medals. Tell you what, there isn't a rule change. There isn't a change in format. There isn't anything that nerfs Japan. You know what I mean? I mean, they always win the medal counts. It's just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, they just, it's their sport. So
yeah,
we're just playing it, you know?
Yeah, I know, but it's just, it's always that way. And I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I'm just surprised it's been this way for over half a century, you know, since the invention of the International Judo Federation. It's how it's always been. It's just, it's really unbelievable. Now France was second in terms of medal count, but in terms of overall finishes, they had, they were first place in overall top seven finishes. So they had 3 gold medals, 1 silver, 7 bronze, 8 fifth place finishes, and 6 seventh place finishes. So really a really good, overall, a really good day for France. I mean, you would expect that kind of success when you've got such a strong team and you're entering, you know, the B and C teams of Team France, you know, 55 competitors. That's a huge turnout. So, any parting thoughts on the Paris Grand Slam for you?
Yeah, I thought that maybe these rule changes would change the way judo was played in a bigger way. But, you know, looking at this tournament and then a little bit of Portugal Grand Slam or Grand Prix, it's still judo. still what I expected.
Yeah, I think the rule changes were largely tweaked, but it didn't negatively impact the sport at this level, in my opinion.
I'm liking what I'm seeing overall. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, did you watch the Olympics? I assume you did.
I did. Yeah. I watched all of it.
What did you
every
think?
Division. I spent so much time watching. It was great.
It was great.
Yeah, it was great.
I saw
some wild cards through there.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. So that's going to do it for this episode of the Judo Chop Suey podcast. I would like to thank Christian again for joining me. I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation, and I know that we're going to do it again sometime soon. Certainly later on this year, probably to cover the World Championships. I enjoyed breaking down the Paris Grand Slam with somebody else. It was nice to get the back and forth there. Now, on my next episode of the Judo Chop Suey podcast, I already got it in the can. I'm going to have Tabor and Lee back on to discuss the tournament that he started, or he was one of the people that started it, the Judo Submission Grappling. It's a new tournament format being put out by USA Judo. I thought that was a really interesting discussion. I can't wait to release that. I will probably release that when I come back from my trip, which will be less than 2 weeks from now. I just still need to do some post-editing, and there's a video review that's going to be on that episode. I'm not going to give it away just yet, but there's a video series that I've been watching over the past couple of weeks that is just, it is the best judo / grappling instructional I have ever watched in my life. So I will be sure to give a full breakdown and a full review on that, but I'm not ready to give it up just yet. So with that, I will have an after party. Christian is going to join me on that after party, so that's going to be fun. But as far as the regular podcast, judo-related stuff, I'm going to put an end to it here. So with that, I hope you all have a great day. I hope you all have a great rest of the week. Train hard. Stay safe out there. And until next time, I'm out.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Open Gangnam Style. Hey, sexy lady. Op, 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 op. Open Gangnam Style.
The after party starts in 15 minutes.
So, Christian, you are the first guest to appear on the after party. So, as you know, this is a part of the podcast where I talk about anything but judo. Usually it's what I'm watching on TV and stuff. Are you watching anything lately at Disney Plus, on Netflix, anything that you want to cover?
You know, I'm not watching really anything that's new. I'm watching old old stuff. Like I'm rewatching. I grew up as a kid watching King of the Hill.
Yeah,
and then I had never seen, I'd seen probably an episode or two, but I had never watched Seinfeld. So I'm going through watching Seinfeld right now.
Oh, are you really? Okay.
Yeah, and it's great, I have to say. And it's a show about nothing, and I missed out. I'm enjoying it right now.
That's funny, because I'm probably, maybe close to twice your age. I'm at least 20 years older than you. So when I was in my 20s, you know, Seinfeld was it. It was like Thursday nights, I think. Seinfeld would always, that was must watch TV for me before the days of DVRs. If I wanted to watch something, I would have to set it on a VCR and get my VHS tape and watch it if I was doing
I remember those
else.
Days.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe you're not as young. How old are you?
I'm 26, 27 this year.
You're still around?
I remember the VHS.
Yeah, I guess
I remember the dial-up. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I'm a younger millennial, but, we remember.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, Seinfeld was great. King of the Hill, I never really got into. I was always a Beavis and Butthead guy, because that's when I was in high school in the late 80s through early 90s. Beavis and Butthead was Mike Judge's show before King of the Hill. Mm-hmm. And he based the King of the Hill character off of one of the characters that he created.
Yeah.
on Beavis and Butthead,
and he uses the same voice
pretty
much. Yeah.
Yeah, so I've seen a few episodes of King of the Hill. It just never resonated with me. Back then, it was always in the 90s. It was The Simpsons for me.
Simpsons.
Yeah. But as soon as 2000 hit, it seemed like The Simpsons went downhill for me. So I really haven't watched The Simpsons in over 20 years, honestly. But that period between 89 and 99 was just gold for me with The Simpsons. Now I'm watching a couple of shows that I've watched on Netflix. Ozark season 4 dropped, which was just phenomenal. I'm also watching The Book of Boba Fett on Disney Plus. What a huge disappointment for me. I've talked about The Mandalorian, where
that was great.
Oh, The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
It made
space Western,
Oh yeah. And it made Star Wars feel like a very dangerous universe to be in. And here I am, I'm watching The Book of Boba Fett. I think they're going to take a page out of The Mandalorian, and it just feels Disney-fied. Like I'm waiting for Boba Fett to shoot somebody in the head. I don't think he's killed anybody yet. The Mandalorian, when the Jawas were taking apart his spaceship, he was killing Jawas. It's that universe is supposed to be a violent universe. Yeah, I don't need to see heads lopped off and blood squirting at it. Like, I don't need to see that in Star Wars, but it's got to be a dangerous and violent place. And this Boba Fett, I mean, he's like a benevolent Boba Fett. Like, that doesn't even make sense to me. You're a bounty hunter. There's no room for being a nice guy. It's Boba Fett has been a disappointment. In fact, I've got two episodes to catch up on. It's almost like trying to force myself to take my medicine. I'm committed to the show, and it's like I gotta watch it at this point. What else? The latest Spider-Man movie. I'm still debating whether or not if that's better than Spider-Verse. I loved last one. Spider-Verse I thought was the best Spider-Man movie before. What the heck is this one even called? Into the Metaverse now. I don't remember what the actual title is called, but I watched the Spider-Man movie, I think, on Christmas Day, and it was fantastic. It was just a brilliant movie. I'm having a tough time trying to determine whether I liked it better than Spider-Verse, but to me, it's like a tie. Did you see that one?
I did, yeah. Well, I've seen both of them, and the one with all three Spider-Mans, Toby. I think it was pure fan service.
It was.
And I was here for it,
Yeah, yeah, it was great. I loved it. They got all the old characters. And, you know, one thing I didn't like about the old Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies is that they killed off the character. They killed off the villains. And like, I, in the comic books, you know, when I grew up watching or grew up reading Spider-Man in the comic books, the villains would be like, you know, shaking their fists in the air. I'll get you, Spider-Man. They'd escape. And, you know, they didn't get, Spider-Man didn't kill them. You know, they didn't get killed off. So I really liked seeing all of those characters come back. I thought it was really well done. And I liked having Doctor Strange back in there. I saw the Eternals. I didn't care for it all that much. I thought it was kind of a dud.
Did you appreciate it's like a different format from like the traditional Marvel film?
What I appreciated a lot was a lot of references, because I've been doing a lot of reading on old civilizations and stuff throughout history. So I love the references to Mesopotamia. And they paid some, how would I put it? A lot of the characters in the Eternals were not truly Mesopotamian gods that they worshipped, but they did a lot of, they made references to how those civilizations did live according to their stories and such. So I thought that part was really interesting. I thought a lot of the characters that they used was interesting. It just didn't resonate with me nearly as much as Shang-Chi, which I thought was, did you see Shang-Chi?
I caught half of it on the airplane, but over what I saw, I really enjoyed that one.
Shang-Chi a lot. That was one of the best Marvel movies that they've made. I went into it not knowing who he was, what it was about. And I was very, very surprised and pleasantly surprised. It was a great movie. What games are you playing as of late?
Yeah, I think of myself as, you know, I like almost all genres. So yeah. From the first person shooter realm, you know, the hardcore first person shooter Escape from Tarkov had a really big patch as of late. That made it really good. It's really interesting game. I unfortunately bought the new Battlefield game, which seems to be a dud. Fingers crossed it turns into something good like Battlefield 5, but yeah, it's a dud.
See, that's funny you say that, because so my go-tos right now, two now, because I have a PlayStation 4. And one of the free games this month was UFC 4. So I installed that and I've been playing it a little bit. But really my go-to for the past 4 or 5 months have been Battlefield 5. I love Battlefield 5. I'm a camper. I'm a sniper. I sit there and I scope people. I spot people and I shoot people from like 400, 500 yards, from meters. I love headshotting people, because I know what they're thinking, because when it happens to me, I'm like, oh, what the hell just happened? Like when you get those headshots from like 400 meters away, and if somebody's running across the field, they think they're good that nobody sees them, and then bam, they're just dead. Love that. The Battlefield 5 is great.
Do you know the map, the like broken down theater map?
The broken down
like the movie theater or one? We have to fight in the center.
I have not played this. So I mainly play Conquest. That's my favorite game mode. So I'm not familiar if that's a team deathmatch one.
A Rush or the Rush equivalent one.
I rarely play Rush. I don't like Rush. Frustrates me. I don't know what it is about Rush. I liked Rush in Battlefield 3 and 4, but it just doesn't. It doesn't do it for me in Battlefield 5. I don't know what it is. I guess I love the Conquest map so much that I just like getting on a mountainside and just scoping and sniping. that's what I do. And then I get into, if I'm not playing a sniper, I'm playing the assault class and blowing up tanks. That's so much fun.
But, you know, with the Battlefield 2042.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I heard these same things about Battlefield 5 when it first came out. And I bought Battlefield 5 on sale for like $1 when it right before 2042 came out, and I was like, I've been sleeping on Battlefield 5, man. It's great.
It's a fun, it's a fun game. It seems like with all the Battlefields, I'm sure they do it on purpose because they're just trying to make a buck.
Like EA.
Exactly. They roll out crap and they patch the hell out of it later, and it ends up being a good game. So by the time, Battlefield Hardline, I thought sucked. I didn't even pay for that. I played the beta. I'm like, there's no way I'm paying for this game. But Battlefield 3, Battlefield 4, they had tough rollouts. I liked Battlefield 1.
That was an amazing game.
Battlefield 1 was great. I love that game. But I guess all of them have really bad rollouts. So I haven't bought Battlefield 2042.
Yeah.
Haven't bought it simply because I'm waiting for it to get patched and fixed. And, you know, I'm sure they probably got rubber banding issues and all this other stuff. And
but, they do.
do they? Yeah. See, I can't deal with that.
Yeah, you know, save your $50 and
I'm gonna wait to
buy a different game.
I don't buy new games anymore. I think the last new game that I bought was a Jedi Fallen Order. That was the last full price game that I bought. Was a Star Wars game, which was brilliant.
Oh, speaking of the Star Wars, I'm so looking forward to the Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic RPG game that they're going to remaster, because that game is probably my favorite game of all time.
Are they remastering that?
They are, yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I for the PC only?
I feel like they're going to do it for consoles too. Yeah.
I might have to get that, because I bought a remastered version of not Jedi Academy. It was the one before that. I bought a remastered
Jedi Knight.
No, Jedi Knight was way before that. You had Jedi Academy, and then maybe it was Jedi. No, see, there was Dark. It was not Dark Forces 2 Jedi Knight. That's really old. But I bought it. I bought a remastered game for the PlayStation. It was one of my favorite Star Wars games. But I think the Fallen Order was the best one that they've made. But Knights of the Old Republic, if they're gonna remaster that, I'll get that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that game was so influential to give us, you know, Skyrim and Fallout. You know, it paved the way. For games like that, you know,
in the
RPG world.
I tell you what, I wish they put out a new Skyrim game, or not Skyrim. I wish they put out a new Elder Scrolls game.
Oh, me too, man.
Yeah, I really. I've been tempted to buy the remastered version of Skyrim again.
Me too. I don't want to give them any more money.
Yeah, that's how I feel. That's exactly how I feel. I don't want to give them any more money. It's like
I bought it for the Xbox 360, and I'm gonna buy Skyrim again in 2022. No,
I can't do that. Yeah, exactly. Right, I can't do it. I can't bring myself to it. You know, maybe if they sell it for under $10, I'll do it. But I mean, I liked Oblivion better anyway. But Skyrim has been Skyrim was a wonderful game too.
The NPC interactions in Oblivion still hold a special place in my heart.
Yeah, amazing. They're really great.